Self-ownership includes the right to decide what substances we're going to swallow, snort, smoke, or inject. My body, my choice.
We are in the middle of a population-wide experiment here that we have not thoughtfully considered.
Pretty much every objection that you can raise against an illegal drug can be raised with equal or greater force against alcohol. Yet alcohol is legal.
This is a crime of risk, and societies have the right and the duty to try to mitigate those crimes.
By what principle of justice do you lock someone in a cage for doing something that violates no one's rights?
As a society, we have a right and a duty to protect people around people making terrible decisions.
Now for the main event. Arguing for the affirmative, Jacob Sullum. Jacob, please come to the stage. Again, tonight's resolution reads that Jacob will be defending, except for laws prohibiting the sale of drugs to minors and driving while impaired, all laws that penalize drug production, distribution, possession, and use should be abolished, along with special sin taxes on drugs. Taking the negative, Alex Berenson. Alex, please come to the stage. Jane, please close the voting. Thanks.
Thanks, Jane. I know at some point I'm going to spill this water.
I can see that coming.
It's a bit tilted. All right. We'll see. A few years ago, police in Habersham County, Georgia, broke into a home in the middle of the night. They were looking for a man who had allegedly sold methamphetamine to a confidential informant a few hours before. The drug dealer was not there, but his uncle, aunt, and four cousins, ranging in age from 1 to 7, were sleeping in the converted garage, having moved there after their house in Wisconsin burned down. As police stormed into the room, one of them tossed a flashbang grenade, a blinding, deafening explosive device that is supposed to distract and disorient suspects so they are less likely to resist. The grenade landed the youngest child's crib, where it exploded in his face and nearly killed him, causing severe burns and a deep chest wound. The toddler spent several weeks in a medically induced coma, followed by multiple surgeries aimed at reconstructing his face and repairing the damage to his chest. Now, several factors contributed to this horrifying incident, including a questionable search warrant and reckless military-style tactics that never should have been deployed against a home where innocent adults and children were living. But the underlying cause was a policy of using violence in situations where violence is not morally justified. The event that precipitated this disastrous raid was a peaceful, voluntary exchange between two adults. One had money, the other one had a psychoactive substance that legislators had arbitrarily decided to ban. Such bans legalized police conduct that would otherwise be universally recognized as felonious, including breaking and entering, burglary, robbery, grand theft, kidnapping, assault, manslaughter, and murder. The rationale for legalizing those crimes is that force is necessary to prevent people from using drugs that might otherwise cause problems for them. But that rationale violates the classical liberal principle that people are sovereign over their own bodies and minds. According to that principle, we have a right to control our own bodies as long as we respect the corresponding rights of other people. Self-ownership includes the right to decide what substances we're going to swallow, snort, smoke, or inject. My body, my choice. When politicians violate that principle, bad things happen, starting with the violence that is necessary to enforce their pharmacological prejudices. Sometimes the scale of that violence makes it impossible to ignore. The anti-drug crackdown in the Philippines, for example, has killed more than 12,000 people since the current president took office in 2016. But even in our own country, police periodically kill people in the course of enforcing our drug laws. Several years ago in New Orleans, police broke into a marijuana dealer's home and shot him dead. The officer who filed the lethal shot said he thought that the unarmed dealer was threatening him with a gun. Just this last January in Houston, police broke into the home of a middle-aged couple without warning and immediately used a shotgun to kill their dog, which set off an exchange of gunfire in which both of the homeowners were killed. And the warrant for this raid claimed that the couple was selling heroin, but police didn't discover any evidence of drug dealing, and in fact, it turned out the warrant had been falsified. Another way in which drug prohibition fosters violence is by creating a black market where there are no peaceful legal ways to resolve disputes, whether between competitors or between buyers and sellers. One good example of that is what were known as crack-related homicides back in the 80s. There was a study that looked at all of the murders that were classified that way, and it found that contrary to the impression you might have gotten from politicians and journalists, these were not murders that were committed by people under the influence of crack. These were almost entirely murders that grew out of black market disputes. That sort of violence combined with violence between the government and drug traffickers figured in the Mexican drug war that is believed to have killed about 60,000 people between 2006 and 2012. The black market that generates violence also generates artificially high profits, since drug traffickers can earn a premium by dealing in contraband. A recent RAND Corporation estimate figured that Americans alone spend about $150 billion a year just on four drugs: marijuana, heroin, cocaine, and methamphetamine. The worldwide market is probably worth three or four times as much. Profits from that business strengthen murderous criminal organizations and foster corruption throughout the law enforcement system. Such corruption is rampant in countries such as Mexico and Honduras, where drug lords can escape capture and break out of prison with help from the same officials who are supposed to be chasing them down and locking them up. But you also hear pretty frequently about drug-related corruption in the United States. I'll just give you a few recent examples. This is just within the past year or so. A DEA agent had a drug trafficker buy a nice $43,000 truck so that the agent could turn around and seize it for his own use. Another case involved a Customs and Border Protection agent who was paid for 10 years to facilitate drug smuggling. He would leave certain gates unlocked. Yet another case involved police officers in Baltimore and Philadelphia who would seize drugs and then turn around and sell them. And then you have a perennial problem of correctional officers who smuggle drugs into prisons. As it did during national alcohol prohibition, that sort of corruption tends to undermine respect for the law. So does the sense that police are arbitrarily targeting a small percentage of lawbreakers, because that's all they can manage to do, for arrest and punishment, especially when enforcement has a racially disproportionate impact. One glaring example of that is the difference between federal penalties for the snorted and smoked forms of cocaine. Up until, starting in 1986 and up until 2010, the mandatory minimum sentences for cocaine powder kicked in at weights 100 times as high as the cutoffs for crack cocaine. As a result, low-level crack dealers who were overwhelmingly black tended to get more severe sentences than higher-level powder dealers who were more likely to be white or Hispanic. And the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010 changed that ratio from 100 to 1 to 18 to 1. So if you do the math, you'll see that's exactly 82% less insane. Also, we saw stark racial disparities when the NYPD cracked down suddenly on cannabis consumers during the Giuliani and Bloomberg administrations. These low-level marijuana possession arrests had averaged less than 2,500 under the two mayors that preceded Giuliani. After 1996, they skyrocketed, peaking at more than 50,000 in 2011. And blacks and Latinos that year accounted for 84% of the possession arrests. On its face, this was very puzzling, this surge in pot bust, because New York supposedly had decriminalized marijuana possession back in 1977. But it was still a misdemeanor to possess marijuana that is burning or open to public view. And defense attorneys frequently complained that police would pat down young men, ostensibly looking for weapons, which they almost never found, and then pull out a joint or pull out a bag of weed. Now it's exposed to public view. Now I can arrest you. Another trick was to say, you know, if you have any contraband on you, you probably turn it over to me. It'll work out better for you. It did not work out better, no, because that's now a misdemeanor you can be arrested for. So when you combine that sort of trickery with the routine hassling of young black and Latino men that prevailed under the stop and frisk program, you can start to see why police are widely viewed as the enemy in neighborhoods they're supposed to be protecting. And those disparities that you saw in New York are seen throughout the country. The ACLU estimates that nationwide, black people are about 4 times as likely to be arrested for marijuana possession as white people, even though the rates of cannabis consumption in the two groups are about the same. Altogether, police in the United States made more than 660,000 marijuana arrests in 2018, more than 9 out of 10 for simple possession. So this is not dealing, it's not manufacturing. Most people arrested for possessing small amounts of marijuana are not going to spend a lot of time behind bars, but there are these long-lasting ancillary penalties that make it harder to obtain an education, get a job, find housing. Altogether, including all drug offenses, police in the United States made 1.7 million drug arrests in 2018. At any given time, there are about 500,000 people who are locked up in jails or prisons for drug offenses. Drug offenders account for about half of federal prisoners and about 15% of state prisoners. Arresting all of those people for conduct that violates no one's rights unjustly deprives them of their liberty and impairs their life prospects. It also hurts their families and communities. And it frequently entails draconian penalties, including sentences of years, decades, and even life for nonviolent offenses. Now, prohibition obviously makes life worse for drug users by exposing them to the risk of violence and the risk of arrest, but you also have the problem that when you're in a black market, you don't know what you're buying. If you buy a bottle of whiskey, you can be pretty confident how much alcohol is in that. Not the same when you buy black market products, you don't really know what's in them. Very dramatic demonstration of that was the crackdown on pain pills, after which opioid-related deaths were on an upward trend that not only continued but accelerated. Why? Because people who had been using opioids that were delivered in legally produced reliable doses were suddenly using black market products instead, and these are widely variable in terms of purity and potency and unpredictable. More likely that you're going to make fatal errors. Fentanyl has only compounded this problem because it's increased the variability. And this is also a phenomenon that's driven by prohibition because prohibition drives drug traffickers toward more potent substances that are easier to smuggle. You also have the motivation to inject drugs that are artificially expensive, which leads to, and combine that with rules that obstruct access to clean injection equipment, you're now spreading AIDS and hepatitis. You have soft tissue infections as a result of not having sanitary equipment. And one of the really notable things about these burdens is that for the most part, they're falling on people who do not benefit from them. Because the people who are being punished are the ones who are defying prohibition. The people that you imagine you're helping are the ones who are deterred by prohibition from making poor choices that they would otherwise make. And I think that is really morally questionable, even if you believe in paternalism as a rationale for government intervention. Which is not to say that the burdens of prohibition fall exclusively on people who like illegal drugs. The rest of us all pay. I shouldn't say us. Everyone else pays in the form of squandered taxpayer money, diverted law enforcement resources, theft driven by artificially high drug prices, and eroded civil liberties. The war on drugs has been the main reason why the Supreme Court for decades has been whittling away at the Fourth Amendment's ban on unreasonable searches and seizures. Just a few examples. The court has said it's okay to rummage through your trash without a warrant. You can surveil private property from low-flying aircraft without a warrant. You can impose mandatory drug testing on public school students. You can get search warrants based on anonymous informants who may or may not exist, and they often do not exist. And you can justify a search based on a cop's report of a dog's signal. The war on drugs is also the main excuse for the system of legalized theft that's known as civil asset forfeiture, where they can take money or other property claiming that it is connected in some way to drug offenses, then the burden is now on the owner to get it back. It often costs more to get back the property than the property is worth. We could avoid these disastrous consequences if the government decided to respect the individual's right to control his own body, including the substances that enter it. The government would still have a role, as it does with alcohol, in enforcing laws against fraud, protecting the public from reckless behavior, such as impaired driving, and defending parents' authority by imposing age restrictions on drug sales. But it would otherwise leave adults free to make their own choices. Thanks. I did not spill my water. I want credit for that.
Alex Berenson for the negative. Alex, take it away.
I want to thank Jacob for that. Also, Gene, thanks for having me. Jane, thanks for setting up. I think David already won our debate. So it's sort of funny that I'm up here because until a few years ago, I was a reporter for the New York Times who mainly covered the legal pharmaceutical industry. And for the last few years, I've been writing spy novels. And then this year, at the beginning of this year, I wrote a book about cannabis, which attracted some attention. And I think that's why I'm here. But it is sort of strange that I am one of the seemingly leading voices in the nation now about why we should keep cannabis or not legalize cannabis, why we should keep it in at most a decriminalized state. And now I seem to be broadening that to talk a little bit more about drugs in general. But the reason that is that there are so few people out there who are willing to talk about why drugs should remain illegal. There's a tremendous infrastructure to fight the drug war, but all of those people are fighting tactical battles. They're all trying to, whether they're doctors trying to treat addicts or whether they're law enforcement officers trying to make arrests, it's as if we have forgotten the reason we do this. And there are very, very important reasons to keep keep drugs illegal. And we can discuss decriminalization versus prohibition, what those terms mean, but why it is as a society that we should have bans on drug use. Jacob and the libertarians and on the other side, liberal policy groups have really seized the philosophical high ground here, and they've been making the same arguments over and over and over again for 30 years. What was so striking to me about Jacob's discussion was that he could have said it 30 years ago, actually, or 20 years ago, or 10 years ago, and yet so much has changed in the last 30 years that really puts the lie to a lot of those arguments. The drug legalizers, sometimes they call themselves drug reformers, and I admire Jacob for having the guts to say it, to call himself a legalizer. They really make the same arguments over and over again. There's sort of an inherent amount of drug use in society. We can't change that. We can't reduce that. We can, it's going to rise or fall on its own. We can only manage it and manage the consequences. We can't stigmatize use. That just hurts people who are using. That just discourages them from getting help and drives them underground. The harm of the use is mainly to the individual, and that's where we should that's where we should focus our attention. Jacob said problems for them, problems for the user. Let's focus on the user and his or her problems. Let's not worry about the people around the user and the problems that use may cause. The harm to society, as Jacob said explicitly, comes from the drug war, not the pharmacological consequences of drug use. And thus, obviously, the drug war is a mistake. Some people will go so far as to say the pharmacology of drugs does not drive addiction. Addiction comes from trauma growing up. That most people who use heroin even do not get addicted, which is true, by the way. A majority of people who use do not get addicted, and therefore we shouldn't think of the drug as the problem. The drug is the solution the user is using to treat some other problem in his or her life. Oh, and another point legalizers like to make is that all drugs are basically the same. Caffeine is alcohol, is methamphetamine, is heroin. Everything is the same, and therefore they all deserve to be treated under the same legal scheme. Jacob used the word arbitrarily to discuss efforts to introduce distinctions there. And so the legalizers have made these arguments over and over and over again for 30 years, and they've basically won. They've certainly won in the media. They've won in academia. And there's almost nobody out there who's willing to say, you've been making these arguments. Real life has gone exactly the other way. So let's look at some of the public health changes in the last 30 years. We stigmatize tobacco use. Tobacco kills more people than any other substance. And we decided we didn't like that, and we stigmatized use. And the vaping crisis notwithstanding, we have driven tobacco use way down in the United States and all over the Western world. We stigmatized drinking and driving very successfully, and drinking and driving deaths are down in the United States and all over the Western world. We stigmatized drinking during pregnancy, and fetal alcohol syndrome went down. You can change patterns of use if you tell people. People don't really want to hurt themselves. You can tell them things, truthful things, and they will listen to you, and they will change their behavior on their own. At the same time, we embarked on a giant, giant experiment involving medically prescribed opioids. The amount of medically prescribed opioids in the United States went up about sixfold between 1995 and 2010. And Jacob is wrong when he says the deaths were not soaring in the decade of the aughts, long before we started to try desperately and basically unsuccessfully to discourage this. The United States still has five times the amount of opioid prescriptions as it did in the mid-90s. There has been no change in our health that would drive that. That is a result of doctors and drug companies unfortunately making bad decisions. And these, remember, these are medically prescribed, they're usually insurance paid, and they have led to the worst public health crisis in modern American history. 500,000 people have died from opioid deaths since 2000, and many of those people were taking medically prescribed opioids, not fentanyl, not heroin. These were people who became addicted and couldn't stop and died. And many of them died very quickly. The standardized mortality ratio for somebody who's an opioid addict, a heroin addict, I should say, I'm not entirely sure what the number is if you're an oxy addict, is about 20. That means you're 20 times as likely to die in the course of a year if you're a heroin addict. You're about five times as likely to die if you're a cocaine addict. That's not because the drugs are illegal. It's because being addicted to these drugs is dangerous. It's dangerous for you, and it's dangerous for the people around you. So again, if the problem is drugs and not the war on drugs, I don't understand why OxyContin has killed all these people. So the legalizers have a solution to the problems that legalization causes: harm reduction. Harm reduction means trying to fix addiction generally, trying to fix problematic use. And how do we do that? We do it with rehab. We do it with empathy for the user. We do it with support for the user. Unfortunately, none of those things actually work. The only thing that there are only two ways to convince people to quit using drugs. One is for them to quit on their own, and the other for opioid addicts is to give them what the harm reduction community euphemistically likes to call medication-assisted treatment. Medication-assisted treatment means giving somebody who's an opioid addict a different opioid that you hope won't kill them. So you give them Suboxone or Bupe, and those drugs are less likely to kill you than heroin or fentanyl. Doesn't make you less of an addict. You still need the drug to function. But that is the only harm reduction strategy that really works, that or quitting. So what the legalizers say is, let's let everybody use, let's not discourage it. It's a moral neutral, it's neither good nor bad, and we're going to try to pick up the problems that inevitably result from use. Unfortunately, this was true in China in 1850, and it's true in the United States in 2019. It's very simple. The larger the population of people you expose to dangerous drugs, the greater the harm. It's like giving people cars that can drive 200 miles an hour. Okay, no matter what safety measures you put on there, you're going to kill more people than if they're driving at 75. The inherent extra risk cannot be mitigated by harm reduction. It can only be mitigated on the way in by discouraging use. And that's what you have to decide to do as a society. And societies can do this. Jacob tried to argue that adults should be allowed to use. So we ban texting and driving, for example. We ban drinking and driving. You can drive 50 miles drunk or on your phone and be pulled over by a cop 30 feet from your house. Why? Because Drinking and driving or texting and driving are crimes of risk. We ban those things not because we know they're going to harm somebody, but because they increase the inherent risk. And it is the same with drug use. That is the correct way to think about drug use. It is a crime of risk. Doesn't mean that everyone is going to be hurt. It doesn't mean that everyone is going to do something terrible to his or her family or to the people around them or commit crimes to finance his or her drug use. It means that this is a crime of risk, and societies have the right and the duty to try to mitigate those crimes. So obviously I know more about cannabis than other drugs. And one of the interesting arguments that legalizers like to make about legalization is that somehow prohibition drives up potency because dealers want to sell more potent product. And in this, they talk about prohibition. That was certainly true during prohibition. But there's a big difference between alcohol and every other drug, which is that alcohol is dosed by, you know, the gram or the ounce, or, you know, in the case of beer, there are kegs. It's a big, heavy drug. To smuggle a lot of it, actually, it does make sense to give people more potent products. With cannabis / THC and with other drugs, that's not true. These drugs are dosed by the microgram, the milligram, the gram. And the fact is, what drives use and potency and danger is the user demand for more potent drugs. And that is the American experiment with cannabis legalization proves that beyond a doubt. Everybody who was in favor of legalization said, you know, there'll be people who want higher CBD products. We're not going to see a big increase in THC. Exactly the opposite has happened. Basically, dispensaries are selling 25 or 30% THC cannabis, flower cannabis, when 15 years ago the standard was 5 or 6%. And for a lot of users, even that isn't enough. They want near pure semi-synthetic extracts that are basically THC. User demand drives potency more than prohibition. So that is another myth that legalizers say. So what do you do when you have all these problems? You deny them and you focus on an unfortunate few, and I will say police crimes, because the conduct Jacob described certainly sounds criminal to me. Cases where the drug war has gone too far, where police have acted unethically or illegally, and you ignore the fact that the vast majority of child deaths in the United States, has far more child deaths than any other industrialized country, and I'm talking on a per population basis, come at the hands of people using. Okay, we are the legalization community has focused our attention very successfully on the harm that users face, and it has somehow distracted us from the fact that it's actually the user is actually benefiting from his chemical euphoria on some level. The real harm, the truest harm, comes to the people around the user, the innocents who have to deal with addiction, and innocents, most of all, children whose parents are using and can't take care of them. And for every case that Jacob mentioned, I could unfortunately tell you 10 of parental drug users who did horrible, horrible things to their kids. Okay, So we have a right and a duty as a society to discourage drug use. Now, we can discourage it legally. We call that prohibition. We can discourage it through ad campaigns. We can call that stigma. I would lump all of this as prevention. And we can make distinctions between different drug classes, and we can make distinctions between the harm that they cause, and we can and should do that as a society. We should not just say, this is a moral neutral, and we can't control it, and all we can do is clean up the after effects, because that's not true, and it leads to higher use, and higher use inevitably results in more harm and more death. Thank you.
Rebuttal from Jacob, you want to take this podium?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
So I want to explain why I say the drug laws are arbitrary. Not that all drugs are the same or have the same costs and benefits, but for example, pretty much every objection that you can raise against an illegal drug can be raised with equal or greater force against alcohol. Yet alcohol is legal. So the laws are arbitrary in that sense. They're not based on a scientific evaluation of the hazards of each substance, which leads to a decision about the legal status. Alex mentioned several things, positive things that were accomplished without prohibition. Decrease in smoking, which has gone down dramatically over the last few decades. Decreases in drunk driving, decreases in heavy drinking during pregnancy. We didn't ban alcohol. We didn't ban tobacco. In terms of opioid prescriptions and opioid-related deaths, certainly it's true that people were dying after using prescription pain pills, typically, by the way, in combination with various other drugs. The data out of New York City indicate that 97% of so-called overdose deaths are actually involve combinations of drugs. Drug-related deaths have been going up since the late 50s, actually, and this is all happening under prohibition. This is a long-term trend, and you're looking at people engaging in reckless drug behavior, possibly getting more reckless. For sure, the availability of pain pills has something to do with the fact that pain pills, were used, but it doesn't mean that none of this would have happened in the absence of the increase in prescriptions. And in fact, as I mentioned, when prescriptions were brought down by the government, you actually saw an acceleration of the trend. Why is that? Acceleration of the upward trend in opioid-related deaths. The death rate among heroin users is roughly 8 times as high as the death rate among illegal or non-medical users of pain pills. It makes it more dangerous, not less, to crack down on pain pills. Alex poo-pooed the idea of giving people substitute opioids that are in controlled doses that are less likely to kill them. I think that's a good thing, that they're less likely to die. If we're worried about people dying, we should try to reduce the harms associated with drug use. It doesn't make sense to take somebody who is used to using a certain drug every day and throw them into the black market where the drugs are far more hazardous. I would point out availability doesn't automatically translate into higher addiction rates. Opioid-related deaths or drug-related deaths were actually going down prior to the Harrison Narcotics Act, prior to the beginning of drug prohibition in the U.S. The fact that that you legalize something might lead to an increase in use, as we're seeing with marijuana among young adults especially, not, by the way, children, which is interesting. I didn't even expect that. It was counterintuitive. But what we're really interested in is the harm associated with drug use. Increase in use in itself is a benefit. That means more people are getting satisfaction they wouldn't otherwise get. What we're interested in, are they hurting themselves? Are they hurting other people? And is it better in a prohibition situation? I would argue it's not. And the one final thing about the violence, there's violence inherent in the war on drugs. I mean, that's why they call it the war on drugs. So this is not just a few. Yes, some of these cops are unethical and especially reckless. It's true. But it is a necessary part of drug prohibition that you use force to enforce it. You create these situations that have all sorts of potential for going wrong, even if every cop is conscientious about doing his job. So you will have people being killed. And if these, if somebody's not falsely, this guy in New Orleans was actually a marijuana dealer, as far as I know. He wasn't falsely accused. It wasn't a trumped up case. Had he actually had a gun, that would have been considered justifiable use of deadly force by the cop, even though on the face of it, he's defending his own home against armed intruders. So violence is inherent in the war on drugs. You can't eliminate it, even if you all cops are conscientious.
Prime Minister Rebuttal.
I would just say, I do agree with medication-assisted treatment. I think it's the only thing that works. I think it's unfortunate that opioids, once you become addicted to them, have such a hold on you, whoever you are, whether or not you have childhood trauma, whether or not you have a family. They are pharmacologically devastating. And they're so devastating that for many people, the only answer is a substitute addiction, which is less dangerous. Why on earth we would want that product to be widely available, that a product that anybody could walk into a store and buy, I have no idea. Jacob didn't really dispute the numbers that I gave you about standardized mortality. Alcohol, aside from people who are heavy users, has no or a very limited increase in standardized mortality. We're talking about ratios of 1.1, maybe 1.2. And then as you start to use more, as you become addicted, it becomes an appreciable number. But, you know, most the alcohol is not as dangerous as these other drugs. The reason there's a lot of harm with alcohol is because so many people use alcohol. Okay, if heroin or cocaine use approached anything like alcohol use, if even first-time use approached anything like alcohol use because of the propensity of people to become addicted, we would have a devastated society. Okay, cannabis use right now in the United States is only, in terms of casual use, the number of people who used last year in the United States is about 42 million. Okay, more than four times as many people used alcohol. But because people don't realize how addictive cannabis is, the number of daily users of cannabis is almost as high for cannabis as for alcohol. Okay, these drugs do exist on a spectrum, and although cannabis use is more although alcohol use is more physically toxic than cannabis use, I think anybody who reads the studies with an open mind is going to realize that cannabis use is extremely neurotoxic. Okay, there aren't too many drugs that can produce psychosis in people after a single use, and cannabis can, not permanent psychosis, but you know, when you have your edible and you wind up in the ER because you think your friends are aliens, you've had an episode. It's true, it happens. You've had an episode of cannabis-induced psychosis. Okay, so and cannabis is less dangerous. It's less dangerous than cocaine. It's less dangerous than heroin. It's less dangerous than the opioids. It's less dangerous than methamphetamine. It's still a dangerous drug. We are in the middle of a population-wide experiment here that we have not thoughtfully considered. Okay, and in terms of alcohol, what we should be trying to do with alcohol, because a lot of people can use it casually, is to discourage the people who are heavy users, and probably you do that with higher taxes on it, and penalizing people who are inebriated in public or who are drinking and driving, who are clearly using in an unhealthy way. We can't ever prohibit alcohol. We tried it. It didn't work. There are far too many casual users. But that doesn't mean that we want other drugs to follow the same route as alcohol. One last point. Jacob, I think, would certainly agree that the war on drugs has been aggressive for a long time. Crime in the United States decreased dramatically between 1999 and 2014. We successfully, apparently, prosecuted a war on drugs, reduced crime rates nationally, reduced homicide rates, reduced rates of serious violence, and somehow we did all this while fighting this horrible war on drugs. Now, in the last couple of years, we've sort of taken the we've put the brakes on the war on drugs a little bit. We've taught, you know, marijuana arrests are actually down. The legalization lobby is increasingly powerful in cities like Philadelphia and Dallas. There are prosecutors who are openly in favor of legalization. And guess what? In the last couple of years, both homicides and aggravated assaults have started to go up again. The pharmacological effects of drugs are the same whether they're legal or not, and so we should discourage their use. Thank you.
Thanks for a spirited debate between the two of you. We now go to the Q&A section of the evening. People can line up and ask questions. At any time, the rules are, at any time, you can each ask the other a question. And if you'd like to exercise that prerogative right now, then do so if you'd like to. Or we can wait for questions and you can use that prerogative later on.
I'm going to use your prerogative?
Do I get only one prerogative?
Or you get as many as you want.
Oh, all right, then. Can I? May I?
But I can strike your question.
No, no. Okay, yes. You must pick up the microphone. Oh. That's the rule here.
Okay. Jacob, who do you think should pay for the treatment for addicts?
Are you willing to kick in?
You know, is that a serious question?
No, yeah. That's not serious. I think it's analogous to the question of who pays for addiction to whether drugs are legal or illegal. Who pays for alcohol addiction? It's the same analysis. I mean, libertarians are more skeptical of forcing people to pick up the tab for that sort of thing than you are, obviously. I wanted to press you on the point about alcohol, actually.
Okay.
So you said alcohol is not as dangerous as these other drugs. You conceded that it is physically, like heavy drinking is physically more deleterious than heavy pot smoking, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay. So also in terms of affecting driving ability?
That is not clear.
Marijuana versus, I think it's, okay. All right, I guess I disagree on that. I think it's very clear that alcohol has a much more dramatic effect on driving ability.
You should look at the statistics from the legalized states.
That doesn't go to the relative effect on driving ability. That's established in laboratory studies where they look at how people's performance is affected. But okay, so that's what I'm saying is that is another difference. If you look at addictive liability, I mean, studies typically indicate the addiction rate for alcohol is higher than with marijuana. It actually is higher than in surveys. I mean, what do you buy this idea that exposure to opioid pain pills in itself causes addiction, or is it a function of the circumstances?
I think it causes addiction. I mean, there are going to be people who are more vulnerable. But if you expose everyone in this room to a course of OxyContin for a month or a week, some of those people will become addicted.
Some, but some. The vast majority not.
Yes, the majority not. I don't know if I'd say we can argue about
that. Right. I mean, how many people here have used opioids, opioid pain pills?
Okay, show of hands. Yeah. Let's turn on the lights. Okay.
Can't see. Okay. And how many of you, after your pain was gone, had trouble giving it up and became addicted?
Okay.
I don't see any hands. So that's 100%. We're not addicted.
There actually was.
There was
a hand.
No. But actually, if you look at, there was one hand. Okay. So, but if you look at the data on drug use disorder, right, among people who use, whether for medical or non-medical purposes, it's about 2% in a given year versus something like 9% of alcohol, drinkers who are have alcohol use disorder in a given year, which again suggests that alcohol is worse or more dangerous in that respect. So, I mean, there are ways, I'm sure, which alcohol is better, too. But it's tastier, for one thing. But I think it goes to the point of the distinctions drawn by the drug laws aren't really based on an objective evaluation of the risk.
Okay, the simple question to you, Alice, was that you do not want to legally prohibit alcohol use, and the answer is the question was again.
No, I do not think we should do that. But I also think that if we're going to talk about, and the best way to look at this is propensity to become addicted after exposure, which is certainly higher for both heroin and cocaine than for alcohol and marijuana.
No, it's not true.
It is true. Right, it is about 1 in 6 for anybody who drinks, and it's about 1 in 3 for heroin.
One study here, I'm sure you have others, but this is based on data from the National Comorbidities Survey. Okay? So alcohol comes in higher than cannabis or prescription analgesics. It comes in higher than amphetamines. It is slightly lower than cocaine. Did you say cocaine?
Yeah, cocaine and heroin are both significantly more addictive.
And the biggest one, you know what the biggest one is, though? The highest rate of addiction, tobacco.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Okay.
So,
goes to the point that these distinctions don't dictate what the laws say. And the other aspect of this is, I mean, you mentioned, bringing down smoking. is that you have to distinguish between addiction and the damage that addiction does. Because addiction in itself is not necessarily damaging. People can be addicted to coffee, as you mentioned. It generally does not cause people much of a problem if they're addicted to caffeine, because they can get it readily. It doesn't have serious health effects. It doesn't disrupt their lives. And you can separate nicotine from the smoking, which, of course, we've done with e-cigarettes. You have something that people can use throughout the day. It's not going to have a serious harm. It's certainly much less dangerous than smoking. And so you've reduced the impact. That's harm reduction, right?
Okay. Alex, that was a long question from Jacob. Do you have any answer you want to give? You have a question, Jacob?
I don't know if that was a question or a question, a comment, okay, or as an old professor of mine, I like to say questions, comments, or short speeches.
Okay.
So anyway.
Okay. All right. Question for the audience. Just ask a question as a question. No need to identify yourself.
Right. So, Alex, would you prohibit marijuana? Medical marijuana, that has not been brought up, which kind of surprised me. Sure. And then for Jacob, are there any studies, empirical studies, where drugs have been legalized, such as Colorado or Portugal, and what are the results? Has drug use increased or decreased?
Good question. So Alex first.
So this will probably be my most unpopular answer of the night. I don't really think there is any such thing as medical marijuana. If you look at the studies around cannabis, aside from a couple of very, very narrow conditions, randomized clinical trials have never shown that cannabis works to treat nearly any of the conditions that it's said to treat. And that, by the way, even applies to pain, okay? You can imagine what the market for a legal prescription non-opioid painkiller would be in this country right now. It would be $5 or $10 or $15 billion a year. A company called GW Pharma, which is a cannabinoid pharmaceutical company based in the UK, for years tried to produce a THC CBD blend that it was going to get FDA prescription approval for to market as a painkiller. That effort collapsed in 2015 and 2016 when the largest clinical trials of Sativex against placebo, not against opioids, showed no benefit in pain. For reasons that actually are even a little bit unclear to me, cannabis does not really work in pain. The conditions that THC and cannabis are said to work for, again, there's almost no evidence. CBD and possibly other cannabinoids may work in other conditions. CBD is Epidiolex, is FDA approved. It's a prescription drug to treat epilepsy in children. That's great. I'm all in favor of that. I'm glad insurance companies are covering it. But that does not mean that medical marijuana is a thing. It's not a thing. I would actually be in and the efforts to encourage people to use marijuana for mild psychiatric conditions are among the worst parts of what the cannabis lobby has done in the last 15 years. If I had to choose, I would choose full recreational legalization over medical legalization, because at least then we would be talking about this as a drug, not a pretend medicine. As the head of a cannabis company said to me a couple of weeks ago, the condition it treats is called not being high.
Do you want to address that question, Alex, before you...
Yeah, just briefly. I mean, I actually sort of agree with Alex that the medical benefits of marijuana have been oversold. We can agree on that. I am a little bit more impressed by the evidence. I mean, the FDA has approved THC to treat nausea and restore appetite, and that initially for cancer chemotherapy, and then later for AIDS wasting syndrome. So there's good evidence on that point. When the National Academy has looked at this, they found substantial evidence for a few indications. You're right. It's not nearly as many as some states.
Skip that note to harmony and then go on to the question that Mark Skousen put to you about the record of legalization in other countries.
Portugal didn't really legalize, but they aggressively decriminalized such that use was no longer an offense. And they have suasion committees. They, instead of arresting people and putting them in jail, they have treatment available. They seem to have had some success. Overdose deaths went down. Transmission of communicable diseases, I believe, went down.
There hasn't been any obvious increase in social disruption, but that is by no means legalization. I mean, just to be clear, it's a form of harm reduction, and I think it, as far as it goes, it's been pretty successful. In terms of Colorado or other states, we, as I mentioned, you see increases in use by adults, which I take to be mostly a benefit. I'm sure Alex disagrees, but to the extent that it's not causing obvious problems, it's a benefit. I mean, people are getting satisfaction they wouldn't otherwise get. I am pleasantly surprised to see that underage use did not go up. I was not one of those people who was saying there's no way that's going to happen, because what happens when you legalize is that, on the one hand, it's true, if you displace the black market, the people in the black market are not checking IDs, and they are serious about checking IDs in the state-licensed businesses, but of course you have leakage from the legal market. So if you have an older brother who's 21 or older, he may get pot for you, you may swipe it from your parents, in the same way that alcohol leaks from the adult market. So that was perfectly plausible to me that would happen. It's kind of amazing that it didn't happen, or hasn't happened so far, and in fact it's gone down slightly, teenage marijuana use in Colorado, and possibly there's something to this idea that when you legalize it and your parents are using it, it's not cool anymore. I'm not sure, but that's sort of interesting. In terms of other indicators, another thing that was legitimate to be concerned about was an increase in stone driving. People would argue this is just going to add to the problems created by alcohol. It is possible that it could reduce the problems created by alcohol to the extent that marijuana is a substitute. That remains unclear whether it's actually serving as a substitute. If people are drinking less, as I mentioned, alcohol has a much more dramatic effect on driving ability. So yes, if you have more stone drivers rather than drunk drivers, that's a net improvement for public safety. It's not clear what's going on in states like Colorado. Yes, you do have an increase in people testing positive for marijuana, but it does not, and were involved in crashes, it does not mean they were under the influence at the time of the crash or that the marijuana has caused the crash. So it's very hard, based on those data, to figure out whether marijuana is actually, you know, causing accidents that otherwise would not be happening.
So I have to push back on this because that's just completely untrue. Basically, all the stuff about driving. Here's the truth, and you can go to the Colorado DOT and look this up. You can go to the Washington DOT and look this up. Overall driving deaths in the states that legalized first are up about 35% to 40% since 2014. Now that's more than the national increase in driving deaths. Even if you adjust for vehicle miles traveled and population, it's significantly more. That's A. B, driving deaths where people were under the influence of THC, and you can distinguish. It is not true that you cannot distinguish between active and inactive metabolites of THC. They do it in tox screens. Driving deaths in which people were under the influence of the active metabolite of THC, it's called Delta-9 THC, not THC-COOH, which is the inactive metabolite. Those deaths have approximately tripled in Washington state. They have approximately, I believe, doubled in Colorado. I'd have to check that. There are a couple of things at play here. People generally will not chug vodka while they drive. They will vape and drive. And some people who vape pass out when they vape. And that is obviously dangerous when you're at speed on a highway. It is also not true that the lab studies show that stone driving is safer than drunk driving. And nor does the data from the CDOT and the Washington DOT. So we are all entitled to our own opinions about legalization, but the facts about what's happened on the roads are clear, and they are not that legalization has made the roads safer. The roads are demonstrably less safe in Colorado and Washington right now.
All right, so I question this equation of testing positive for THC is not the same as being impaired. People can test positive at the cutoff, which is used in Washington or in Colorado for presumptive level of impairment. It's not the same as impairment. Especially people who are regular users, will drive perfectly competently at levels that are above the legal cutoff. It's not equivalent to being impaired. Okay. You can't just assume based on the THC blood level. And the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has made this very clear. You cannot equate THC blood levels to impairment. Unlike with alcohol, it just does not correspond.
I particularly love this argument because if the alcohol industry, if the spirits industry said, you know, heavy drinkers probably can drink two or three times as much, so their BAC levels for impairment should be three times as high, they would be tarred and feathered. But the cannabis industry will make this argument with a straight face.
Well, it's a question of whether people are actually impaired or not, and I actually think that argument has some merit. That, in other words, the alcoholics who are going to be the best drivers under the influence. It's true.
It's not how we do things.
It's true. They should probably get some dispensation.
I admire you for being willing to go there.
But I have to, you know, again, I'm going to differ with you. I mean, I wrote a very long, feature story about marijuana-impaired driving, and I looked very closely at the research about the effects marijuana has versus alcohol. I interviewed a bunch of experts. They all agree. Now, many of them are concerned about stoned driving, no question, but they all agree that, that alcohol has a far more dramatic effect on driving. I think that's very well established, but we'll leave it at that.
Next question.
Hi. I have a son who was arrested 7 years ago for growing marijuana in a Kansas field. He was sentenced to 3 years in the penitentiary of Leavenworth. Now he can't vote. Now he can't do all of those things for growing marijuana. Do you think that that's an equitable punishment for that crime?
Jacob, why don't you say first?
I do not. And
it
I was
got not. Okay, we
I mean I was there actually are people there aren't a lot, but there are people serving life sentences for growing marijuana to serve the recreational market, which is now a legal business in 10 states. So it's kind of astonishing.
Alex.
It's hard for me to answer without knowing, was he growing one plant? Was he growing 100 plants, 1,000 plants? Was he a, you know, was he a...
How many plants?
Okay, over 500 plants. So your son was not growing for personal use. He was a drug dealer, or a drug trafficker, really. Is 3 years an equitable sentence for that? I don't know. I do think, by the way, that in general, and this is a whole different topic, your time should be your time. In other words, once you get out, you should not face not being allowed to vote. You should not have to disclose that, certainly for nonviolent felonies, and this is a nonviolent felony. So it's a different issue. But that's a criminal justice issue. I think sometimes people get confused that ending marijuana prohibition or fully legalizing marijuana, I should say, because we've really ended marijuana prohibition, but fully legalizing marijuana would somehow end these broader issues with the criminal justice system and the social justice issues. And that's not really true. There's a tiny number of people who are serving long prison sentences or really in prison at all for marijuana. I believe the number in Pennsylvania, which has about, I think, 10 million people and has 48,000 prisoners in state penitentiaries is about 80. So, this is not something that a lot of people are in prison for. I'm not saying people don't get arrested, and I'm not saying there aren't racial disparities in those arrests. But when you look at who's actually in jail, I mean, in prison, it's not very many people.
I guess I question the idea that if you decriminalize, possession of small amounts, that means you repeal prohibition. I mean, during alcohol prohibition, it was legal to possess alcohol. If you had accumulated alcohol before prohibition, you were perfectly entitled to have that alcohol and to drink that alcohol. They even created loopholes for supposedly non-intoxicating fermented beverages.
Or for medical use.
So that would be like growing your own pot. But there was no commerce in it that was legal, except for medical purposes, which you probably like that example. You can get a prescription for alcohol during alcohol prohibition. Yeah. Or if you were lucky enough to be Jewish, you had an exemption for sacramental use. Not very good wine, but still. It would get a buzz on.
Did you want to address the question?
But yes. No. My question is, I sense that you don't think people should be arrested or face criminal penalties for using marijuana or having marijuana.
That's absolutely correct.
Okay. So my question is, how do you justify morally saying... the thing we want to prevent is the marijuana use. That's the real crime, but the person who does the actual thing we want to prevent is not going to get arrested. But the person who merely helps them do that by growing marijuana for him, for example, is going to go to prison. It seems. I mean, ordinarily, aiding and abetting is not punished more severely than the crime that you're aiding and abetting. So, how do you justify that distinction?
So, I mean, you are correct that we cannot have a scheme where the drug is not legal, where we aren't punishing a producer and a trafficker in it. So, I mean, that ultimately that is true. So the question is whether or not the user, the individual who who chooses to use a small amount for him or herself, or you know, or on a daily basis for him or herself, we're going to punish that person. As a practical matter, we're not. There's 40 million people used cannabis in 2018. We're not going to put them all in jail, nor should we. That doesn't mean that we can't have laws against the large scale, farming of marijuana, the trafficking of marijuana. And if we're going to have those laws, you're right, they have to have some teeth.
Are you saying, Alex, my clarification, you're saying then that heroin users, cocaine users, any user of an illegal drug is not committing a crime?
We're talking specifically about cannabis.
But in other words, cannabis users, they're okay, but users of the other drugs, they go to prison.
I'm not saying that they go to prison.
Okay.
Okay.
They could go to prison.
I'm saying, yes, they could go to prison. That's right.
For
use for possession and use of these more dangerous.
I see. Okay.
Drugs.
All right. I see. Okay. Just a clarification.
If we're going to be serious about this and talk, specifically, obviously those people should be sent to drug court first. They should have, multiple chances. But at some point, if the laws against use are going to mean something for these drugs, if we are going to make distinctions, which to my mind are non-arbitrary and are based on the danger of the substance, then at some point we might say this drug is dangerous enough that your continued use of it is a crime, not just something where you're going to be sent to drug court. It's a crime.
I see. Next question.
Thank you both for debating tonight. Alex. You've been arguing that drugs are a risk to society and that that's why they should be banned. If you ever tried to buy life insurance, you know that your premiums go up if you're a smoker. So given the proven health risk to society that tobacco causes, why should that be legal? And after that woman who reminded me of my mother, and I can only imagine, I'm in jail for growing some pot, why shouldn't all the tobacco growers be thrown in jail as well for producing a harmful substance? Thank you.
So I think you misunderstand a little bit. It's not so much the harm to society. It's the harm to people around the user, okay? And tobacco doesn't cause psychosis or violent behavior. Alcohol can, that's true. But if you draw a line, okay, and you put caffeine and tobacco on one end as least likely to cause psychosis, and methamphetamine, the hard stimulants, PCP, LSD on the other end, is most likely to cause psychosis. And you track that line, you'll see that societal disapproval of those drugs roughly tracks that line because people don't like psychosis. They're scared of it. They're scared of the violence it produces. Okay, the opioids are sort of in the middle. They actually don't cause psychosis that often. They have other problems. But that's actually, and that's one reason why the cannabis lobby hates my book so much, because it says you've been saying that that cannabis is down here, and the truth is it's much, much higher than you think, and that makes a difference to how we legalize. So there's the tendency of drugs to cause violence, and then there's the tendency of drugs to cause the specific kind of violence that psychosis produces, which is more random and more likely to be targeted at people who had nothing to do with the user,
but,
and that is scary for society, and it should be.
But you still make an exception for alcohol, as you said.
Alcohol tends not to produce psychosis, except in late stage users. It does produce, but yeah. I mean, and I'm not saying alcohol doesn't produce violence. I'm saying that it doesn't produce psychotic violence as much.
Okay, comment about that question, or you want to?
Well, I mean, I don't. You can pick any particular concern. Violence is one of them, and it will not track very well with the distinctions that the drug laws have drawn. I don't know if we're going to get into your book very much, but the experience of most people is that marijuana is not a drug that tends to make people violent. The studies, which I know you question, but the studies of the effects of marijuana do not suggest that it is associated with a violent crime.
That's not true.
The studies that you dismissed, I'm talking about. When the Office of National
studies.
Drug Control Policy commissioned a report from the
in 2012.
From Rand Corporation, they said, and they flatly stated that marijuana does not lead to crimes of violence. You disagreed with that, but it is a study, nevertheless.
It's 8 years old. And most of the studies that I cite in my book have been published since then. if you give a bunch of people who've been screened against any psychotic tendencies or any history of psychosis small amounts of cannabis in a lab setting, you don't find that cannabis produces violence. That's not where cannabis produces violence. Cannabis produces paranoia and psychosis in a small but real minority of users. And when those people have mental illness, or even if they don't, some of them get extremely violent. That's where cannabis produces violence.
All right, let me press you on a couple of things about Anslinger. I'm not the racist stuff. I understand you don't like that. We'll throw that part out. But you seem to be claiming that he recognized what you are now recognizing, right?
Many societies have recognized that Egypt recognized, right, India recognized.
Hang on, let me get to the point, which is that he recognized this connection, in other words, between marijuana use and violence. But at the same time, you say that law enforcement officials typically do not report this, or haven't until recently, and the reason is that you had to wait till marijuana got really potent for this to become obvious. So my question is, how was it that Anslinger back in the 20s and 30s was observing this thing that requires potent marijuana when the marijuana was not very potent?
No, I mean, there's been a connection between cannabis and violence that societies have recognized. The people in India recognized it in the 1890s. Egypt recognized it. By the way, the notion that Harry Anslinger is responsible for worldwide cannabis prohibition is nonsense. The Egyptian government in 1925 was the government that pushed for prohibition of cannabis because it had experience with hashish-fueled violence. So cannabis, even weaker cannabis, can produce violence if you consume enough of it or if you happen to be somebody who unfortunately has a tendency to paranoia and psychosis that the drug brings out. What Anslinger did, what he was a genius about doing, was talking up this and finding ultra cases, just as you found some very good cases about why the war on drugs is a mistake. He was a propagandist. He was not a scientist, but he happened to be right about the science.
All right, so just along those lines, since the early 90s or so, marijuana use has gone up substantially. Potency has gone up substantially,
yes.
Yet crime has fallen in half.
Absolutely. Crime is multifactorial.
Yes, but wouldn't you expect a different result if wider use of marijuana leads to more violent crime?
No.
No, okay.
Crime is multifactorial.
Alrighty.
Next question.
Boy, I really want to go watch Reefer Madness right now. I feel like you'd like it, Alex, if you haven't seen it.
I have.
My question is for you.
Who's you?
For Alex.
Okay.
So about enforcement of the drug war. So in 1933, during the prohibition on alcohol, the government tried to crack down on industrial alcohol sold to manufacturing companies, by putting methyl alcohol in grain alcohol, rendering it lethal. Subsequently, 10,000 people died. Is this justified?
I'd never heard that before. No, it's not justified.
No, I mean, that was what happened.
Is that true?
Yeah, industrial alcohol was allowed for industrial purposes, but they deliberately poisoned it so that it wouldn't be diverted. But it was in fact diverted, and the bootleggers didn't always remove all of the methanol. And that's yes, that's for real. But that's this may not be your perspective, but people today, prohibitionists, some of them seriously will make the argument that you don't want drug use to be safer. You don't want to reduce harm. You want to maximize harm. The better to deter people from using drugs. And so, for example, the governor of New Hampshire vetoed a bill to make naloxone more widely available because he said, we don't want it to be widely available. We don't want to give people the reassurance that if they overdose, they might be saved. We want them to think that they're...
So moral hazard is a real problem, but I think you have to allow naloxone, right?
All right.
Question. Both those things can be true.
We agree on that.
Right.
Next question.
Okay, also for Alex. So you made the argument that drugs are bad, we should discourage drugs, and then all of a sudden, at the end, it jumps in like the whole government should fight the drug war to prohibit them. And it's that last bit that I'd like to understand better. There's crimes of risk. You had this idea, crime of risk.
Yes.
My question is, what is your limiting principle? Meaning, Bloomberg wanted to ban sugary drinks. If I, I want to do something, and I say I don't believe in climate change, and you say you think I'm threatening the existence of the world, do I go to jail? Like, what's your limiting principle for crimes of risk?
So I think you can look at reasonable measures of the effects on the user and the people around him or her. Sugary drinks are not going to make you hurt your family, okay? And they're probably only marginally going to change your standardized mortality ratio. So you can draw non-arbitrary distinctions here. Now, alcohol, it's interesting because alcohol in some ways is like the big, it's always the big legalizer argument because alcohol does have risk. It has significant risk. But I think legalizers of other drugs tend to overstate the risk of alcohol. Not that alcohol doesn't have risk, but remember, 165 million Americans used last year. So we can draw reasonable distinctions.
Comment about the question?
I think it's problematic to say crime of risk, because what you mean is that some of the people who do this, who engage in this behavior, are going to end up hurting other people. Is there no way to distinguish? Do we have to penalize everyone because some minority is going to behave irresponsibly?
Final question. Yeah, of the evening. Go ahead.
Okay, neither of you addressed the carceral state in your opening arguments specifically or in depth beyond police violence or in your rebuttals. And I would like to know how you weigh the social, moral, and economic implications against both your arguments for the drug war's influence in mass incarceration. And I guess as a follow-on question, Alex, why do you hate fun?
I didn't hear that last word. What does he hate? What?
Fun. I'm just high on life, man.
Your question is basically about incarceration. Is that what your question?
Why were neither of you addressing mass incarceration as part of your arguments or rebuttals? What are your thoughts on the social, moral, and economic costs thereof?
A mass incarceration.
Sure.
Let Jacob go.
Yeah, I think I did talk about incarceration and why it's unjust for crimes that violate no one's rights. So the proper penalty for growing marijuana is zero. Zero time is the proper penalty. And so none of those people should be in prison. I would note that anti-prohibitionists or legalizers tend to exaggerate the role of the war on drugs in filling prisons. As I mentioned, the figures, the current figures are about 15% of state prisoners and about half of federal prisoners are there for drug crimes. If you released every single one of them, we would still have way too many people locked up in this country.
How many people altogether, approximately? You said half of something. The absolute number?
The total is...
You said half of the federal prisoners. How many?
I think it's around 100,000, isn't it?
100,000, no? Okay.
15% of the federal...
15% of state prisoners. You're talking about a lot of people. Like I said, it's about 500,000, especially if you include jails, 500,000 people locked up at any given time for violating the drug laws. But you still have a huge number of people who are there for various other kinds of offenses. And if you're serious about attacking mass incarceration, you not only have to say, well, this wasn't so bad a crime or this wasn't so violent a crime, but talk about what's an appropriate penalty for violent crimes. And, the U.S. has this attitude that, 30, 40, 50 years, the rest of your life, that's the right penalty. And it doesn't necessarily, it's not necessarily just, it doesn't necessarily make sense in terms of a public safety payoff. If you look at what happens to people after they've been locked up for years, they become much less likely to recidivate at a certain point. And to keep old men, locked up for the rest of their lives, even if they did commit what you and I would recognize as genuine predatory crimes, it doesn't make sense. But that's, if you're serious about tackling mass incarceration, you have to go beyond the war on drugs and talk about the punishments that we mete out for predatory crimes.
Comment, Alex? Yeah.
That's all true. The average sentence for a murder in the United States is 20 years, and people tend to serve about 2/3. So if you kill somebody and you're convicted, you'll probably do 13 or 14 years. Ag assaults, which are serious assaults, you do 2 to 3 years.
You guys have encouraged each other to digress about the laws.
But I would just say this. So Jacob is right. As to whether or not – the United States has a mass violence problem. And I'm not talking about mass shootings. Obviously, that's a problem too. But we have 17,000 murders a year. We have 800,000 aggravated assaults a year. We have a lot of people in jail because a lot of people commit crimes, unfortunately, in this country. And that's a bigger issue than one that the criminal justice system alone can solve. I personally don't, when I look at the sentences, think they're hugely overstated. But I know that's an unpopular position these days too. But I do admire Jacob for telling the truth about who's in.
Okay, on that note of admiration, I guess we're done, right? Yes, okay. So the Q&A part of the evening is over. Jacob gets a five-minute summary, followed by Alex. Take it away, Jacob.
Okay, so all drugs have risks. There's no such thing as a completely safe drug. Certainly marijuana has risks, alcohol has risks, tobacco has risks, heroin has risks. In many cases, these risks are exaggerated. In many cases, what we think of as being a risk of the drug itself is actually a risk that's created by prohibition. So people, for example, can take opioids for years and years without any serious health damage. Not true of heavy drinking. You will see serious health damage. The real problem is the unreliable quality and potency in the black market. And, you know, Alex says, well, drug dealers are supplying fentanyl because that's what drug users want. By and large, that's not true. They will tell you they would rather avoid fentanyl. Fentanyl is much easier to smuggle into the country just through the mail in a small package. You can get a huge number of doses. It's about 50 times as potent as heroin. So the economic incentives created by prohibition encourage the emergence of drugs like fentanyl. And then you have drugs that are even more potent than fentanyl, fentanyl analogs of various kinds. This is something that's being imposed on people. If they had their choice, this isn't necessarily what they would want. Although there may be a few people out there who love their fentanyl, for the most part, this is something that's being imposed upon them by both the traffickers responding to the economic incentives created by prohibition. People would prefer to know what they're getting and not, you know, accidentally overdose when they take their drug. So we need to separate out the risks that are inherent in certain drugs from the risks that are created by prohibition. And you have to include in your when you're tallying up the cost, not just the unreliable potency and the unpredictable potency in the black market, but also all of the ways in which the law penalizes people for using drugs. That's also a cost. Is it justified? To my mind, it can never be justified in principle because you're punishing these people in order to deter other people who you imagine will become addicted and have drug problems if it weren't for the war on drugs. And I guess I just can't get over, I make both of these arguments. I make the moral argument and I also make a cost-benefit argument. And I think that they complement each other, but I just can't get past this idea that you are using force and violence against people who are not violating anyone's rights. And even though Alex wants to go sort of easy on drug users at the beginning, he says if they keep being bad, they're going to have to be locked up. I just don't get that. By what principle of justice do you lock someone in a cage for doing something that violates no one's rights? That's the bottom line to me.
So the pharmacological effects of drugs are completely independent from whether or not they're legal or illegal. That's the thing to remember about all of this. And so the question is whether or not introducing a large group of people to drugs like heroin or cocaine or super potent cannabis is likely to lead to negative societal outcomes overall. And we know that introducing a large number of people to alcohol, some of those people get eaten, they get swallowed up. And that turns out to be true with cannabis too. I can't really even imagine what it would be like if people could walk into a store and buy heroin or cocaine. The risks, or methamphetamine, and what society would look like. Because, again, the drug legalization community, the drug reform community, has successfully made this about the user when it should be about everyone around the user, because those are the people who suffer the consequences and don't even get the high. And most of the time, those people are completely innocent. And so as a society, we have a right and a duty to protect people around people making terrible decisions. And we can try to protect people from making bad decisions themselves,
you know, obviously there's going to be some people out there who use, you know, who use cannabis, who use alcohol, use tobacco, who use hard drugs, or I shouldn't say hard because, who use heroin, who use cocaine, but we can try to minimize and discourage use, or we can have a society where the producers of those drugs are allowed to advertise them on television and have stores and compete to have the lowest products possible, and that will lead to untold damage, again, not just to the user, but to the people around him or her. And that's what we should be thinking about, and that's why we have the right to prohibit these substances, or to try to prevent their use is really a better word, because we can't prohibit them. They exist, and some people are going to use them, but we can be encouraging their use, we can be morally neutral and societally neutral on their use, or we can actively discourage their use, and we should actively discourage their use. Thank you all.
Well, thanks to both sides for a very spirited debate. We're opening up the voting, so please vote yes, no, or undecided on the resolution. While you're doing that, I want to announce again that the next debate will be Tuesday, November 5th. Richard Wolff, who has been called the leading socialist economist in the country by Cornell West, who's been called by the New York Times probably America's most prominent Marxist economist, will be defending the resolution, socialism is preferable to capitalism as an economic system that promotes freedom, equality, and prosperity. Taking the negative will be me. This debate is going to be held not here, so please, we don't want any stragglers walking mistakenly here on November 5th. It will be held at NYU's Kimmel Center at 60 Washington Square South. That's only about, you know, 8 blocks from here. On the 6th floor, we're going to have our volunteers directing you to the 6th floor. The hall is twice as large as this one. We want a lot of socialist butts in seats for that particular debate. We hope more socialists than libertarians or free market people will be there. We're going to do a major promotion with the Jacobins, with the NYU students, and with the New School students, because Richard Wolff is indeed an emeritus professor at the New School. And so, and then, of course, we will, as we had in the last socialism debate, have Dave Smith up there, hopefully not at as he did in the past, alienating too many members of the audience with some of his jokes. So it could be quite a rollicking evening, and I promise to be totally polite to Richard Wolff. He's actually got 2 or 3 years on me. I regard him as sort of my alter ego. We both sort of learn from the same people. As I've revealed, my mommy was a commie. I learned socialism even before Richard Wolff did. So it will be a very spirited exchange about all aspects of socialism, prosperity, freedom, and equality, I hope you can be there November 5th, again, Kimmel Center at NYU. And how are you doing, Jane? We need a little bit more time. Yes.
Charge the socialists, or do they get to go for free?
Well, the socialists are going to get a huge discount.
I don't know, you know, whether or not I won the debate. I just hope that if you're interested, I have books.
Forgive me, Alex. Wow. Did I let you come down on the job? Sorry. Alex wrote a book about marijuana. It's sold well. Alex, by the way, of course, has written a lot of books that have sold really well. A very accomplished writer, and no matter what you think of his opinions, an engaging writer. And I'm just trying to speak to the libertarians out there, Alex, on your behalf. Mystery writer and lead writer for the New York Times. And so he'll be doing book signing and sales. What's the price, Alex?
You can get it for the low price of $20.
Yeah, just
this is $26. And if I sign it, it's $19.
Okay. Just give him a $20 bill, one of these, and that's very efficient. To buy the book, and that's, of course, what I recommend to everybody. Just take $20 bills. You know, it's too complicated to deal in plastic or Bitcoin, for that matter. So that's great, Alex, and thank you very much for saying that. I really apologize for forgetting that in all of the confusion about this $20 bill. So where do we stand?
Absolute what?
I'm sorry, what did you just say? Okay,
the results are here. Okay, all right. Yeah.
Okay, now I have to dangle the Tootsie Roll in front of... Go on. Okay, here's the Tootsie Roll. All right. Okay. Exactly. I thought that Jane said it was an absolute high. Honestly, I thought she said that. She actually said it was an absolute tie.
Wait,
Oh, sorry. Thank you. Oh, God. Okay. We began, a yes vote was 48.78% yes vote in favor of Jacob, and he rose to 58.54. He gained 9.76% of the vote. And now, because you, Alex, you began with 25.61, pretty good initially, and you rose to 35.37. If you do the math, you two picked up exactly 9.76% of the vote. And so... This is the first. They both got a Tootsie Roll. Well, congratulations to you both.